Numbers chapter 27 this morning. Numbers chapter 27, we're going to pick up halfway through this chapter where we left off last time. And we took a little detour, really, in the story of Moses to look at the lives of the daughters of Zelophehad. And what a story that was, and what a blessing that was to all of our hearts as we read how God was good to these five young women. But then in verse 12, it's a very different part of the story. And there's a transition here. Moses is 120 years of age. He has led Israel for 40 years through many ups and downs, many hardships, many deprivations. And this man, Moses, was an extraordinary individual. He was an extraordinary leader. And the Bible gives us to believe at the end of the book of Deuteronomy, really, that there was no man like him before or after that God spoke face to face. And for 40 years, the nation of Israel had looked to Moses for direction. He had led them from slavery in Egypt all the way now to the border of the promised land. The land that God had promised Abraham and Isaac and Jacob would one day be the land of the Jewish people. But now God is telling Moses in this chapter 27 that Moses' time is running out, that he will not lead them into this promised land. And the irony, of course, in this story is that as the children of Israel get closer to the promised land, every step brings them closer. Every step is bringing Moses closer to his death and to his end. And while the children of Israel are eager, no doubt, and excited to leave the wilderness behind and all the deprivations of the wilderness, Moses, on the other hand, has a bittersweet sense, because he knows that every step closer is a step closer to the border where he cannot cross of the promised land. And the Lord is very direct with Moses in verse 12. And he says to Moses, "Get thee up into this Mount Abiram," or Abiram, "and see the land which I have given unto the children of Israel. When thou hast seen it, thou shalt be gathered unto thy people, as Aaron thy brother was gathered." God is very direct with Moses. He just tells him, "Moses, your time's up. The end is coming." And you know, there are moments like this in every nation, in every company, in every church, in every family, in every individual's life, where God says, "Your time's up. I'm moving on." And there's going to be a handing over of responsibility. And leadership will pass. Accountability and responsibility will pass to someone else. And let me remind you this. Whatever God gives you on earth, ultimately he will take away from you. Someone once said, "Hold the things of earth," whatever that is, material things, power, position, prestige, "hold them loosely in your hand, because God is going to make you let them go. And if you hold them too tight, it'll be more painful to let go of them." And now Moses is having to let go of the power and the position and the leadership of this nation, and someone else is going to take over. Now, in the midst of this, we would say, bitter news, sorrowful news in many ways, God sweetens the bitterness, because he says in verse 13, "Thou also shalt be gathered unto thy people, as Aaron thy brother was gathered." In his loss, and the reminder of his loss, Moses is reminded what he's going to gain. And he's going to gain something far greater than what he lost in not going into the promised land. God says, listen, Moses, you're going to heaven. You're going to be reunited with Aaron and Miriam and the others who've gone before. And Moses, don't be discouraged. Don't be upset. I have taken care of you. You're coming to be gathered onto your people. You're not going to disappear, Moses. You're going to a place where all the people of God are at rest. So while Moses was disqualified from entering the promised land, he wasn't disqualified from entering heaven. Don't make that mistake. There may be things that you feel to do on earth, but there's one thing if you're a child of God you will not feel to do, and that is to make it to heaven and to home. Now, we might have expected God to gloss over Moses' failure. I mean, these are the last moments, really, of Moses' life, although there's just a few months between Numbers 27 and Deuteronomy 34 when he actually does die. We might expect God to pay Moses a very fulsome tribute here and to thank him for his many years of service and to sweeten the pill that way, but he doesn't. He just says to Moses, the good news and the bad news is this, Moses. The bad news, you're leaving this world soon. You're handing over responsibility. The good news is you're not going to disappear. You're on your way to heaven and to home. But then God is very fearful to explain to Moses why. And he does this not to hurt Moses, but he wants you and I to learn from this story that God takes sin seriously. And God takes sin amongst his choicest of servants very seriously. Because he reminds us in verse 14 of verse chapter 27, for ye rebelled against my commandment. I'm not being hard here, Moses. You did wrong. And in the desert of sin, in the strife of the congregation to sanctify me at the water before their eyes, that is the water of Meribah in Kadesh, in the wilderness of sin. So God doesn't gloss over Moses' mistake. God doesn't hide it. He brings it up once again and he says, Moses, this is why. I have to be just and I have to be seen to be just. Now, let me ask you this question. Was this hard for Moses to accept? Was this an easy thing for Moses to receive from God? No, it wasn't. Now, how do we know? This was a hard thing for Moses to receive. Well, if you go to Deuteronomy chapter 3, we get a little insight into the heart of Moses and the pain that he felt and the sense of loss that he felt about not taking Israel into the promised land. Remember, for 40 years, this was his dream, leading him through the ups and downs of the wilderness to bring them into the promised land, to see God's promises to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob fulfilled. For 120 years, as a Jew, Moses no doubt dreamed of going to the promised land, getting out of Egypt. And in Deuteronomy chapter 3, verse 23, Moses reveals something that we don't find in the book of Numbers. He says, I besought the Lord at that time, saying, verse 24, O Lord God, thou hast begun to show thy servant thy greatness, thy mighty hand. For what God is there in heaven or in earth that can do according to thy works and according to thy might? And then he asked God this, I pray thee, let me go over and see the good land that is beyond Jordan, that goodly mountain and Lebanon. But the Lord was wroth with me for your sakes and would not hear me. And the Lord said unto me, let it suffice thee. Speak thee no more unto me of this matter. Get thee up into the top of Pisgah. Lift up thine eyes westward and northward and southward and eastward. And behold it with thine eyes, for thou shalt not go over this Jordan. So Moses felt the pain of this. He didn't shrug this off and say, it's not a big deal. This was the culmination of the lifetime of Moses' labor, Moses' hopes. And God was saying to Moses, no, I'm sorry. Don't talk to me about it, Moses. My mind is made up. My justice demands that you must face this issue. Now, later on we'll discover in the book of Deuteronomy and, of course, in the book of Matthew, that Moses did eventually not just see the promised land before he died, but after he went to heaven, God let him come back from glory to actually stand in the promised land at the Mount of Transfiguration. Now, how will Moses respond now to being told by God, your time is up, your days are numbered? Go back to Deuteronomy, or Numbers chapter 27, verse 15. And Moses spake unto the Lord, saying, let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation, which may go out before them, and which may go in before them, and which may lead them out, and which may bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord be not a sheep which have no shepherd. Now, if you read verse 15 to verse 17, and you'll often hear me say this to you, always look at what's not said as well as what is said. It's very important. And if you look at what's not said first, notice there's no mention of Moses, no mention of I, my needs, my desires, my dreams, no mention of what's going to happen to my legacy. No pleading with God to change his mind. No talking to God, who's going to take care of my wife and children and grandchildren? No mention of, is there a position for them? None of these things concerns the heart of Moses. And having heard the devastating news that his life is about to end, Moses' concern is not for Moses or Moses' reputation or legacy. His concern, and his only concern, is for the people. That God would take care of the nation. And one of the reasons Moses is such a great shepherd is he really cares for this nation. And his hopes and aspirations are for this nation. And you know, most people would be consumed with self at such a moment. Most people would be paranoid about others replacing them at such a moment. But not Moses. He doesn't leave grudgingly. He doesn't need a pity party. He staff that holds his authority doesn't have to be torn out of his hand. He accepts God's will with obedience and humility and meekness. Moses has learned that God's way is the best way. And Moses has learned to do what God calls you to do. And he has learned the painful lesson that only God must choose. And notice how he phrases this in verse 16. Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation. He says God must choose. God is sovereign here, not Moses. He doesn't say, well, I've got a few ideas of my own, or let me go around the congregation and take a poll, or let me try and find a position for one of my sons or my nephews. Remember, at this point, Eleazar, his nephew, is the high priest who has replaced Aaron. And it's only human for Moses to see Aaron's son replace him, for Moses to think, well, what about my son? Or one of my sons to replace me? But he doesn't. He's very, very careful in his language here. And he's very wise, and he gives you and I a great example of facing the future, letting God choose. And he says, Lord, you set a man. And notice what type of character he must be. Verse 17, which may go out before them, and which may go in before them, and which may lead them out, and which may bring them in. What's he using here? He's using military language here. He's using language of leadership. And he's saying, the man that God must choose to be the next leader is one that, number one, God chooses. But number two, is a leader, not a follower. John Calvin, the great preacher of Geneva, told the students at the seminary there that there are three ways to be a leader. Number one, by example. Number two, by example. And number three, well, you can guess it, by example. And you'll never get people to follow a path that you're not willing to follow and lead them down that path. But then notice something else that Moses says. He says in the end of verse 17 that they be not as sheep which have no shepherd. The one who replaces me has to be God's choice, has to be a leader who sets the example, who goes out before them, who leads the way in this nation. But number three, he has to have the heart of a shepherd. Now, remember what I said earlier? Look for what he doesn't say as much as what he does say. He doesn't say to God, choose the best looking one. Choose the one who has got charisma. Choose the one who has the most academic letters after his name. He didn't even say to God, choose one like Moses. You notice that? Choose one of Moses' relatives. He didn't say, choose a CEO. He says, no. Choose a man who has the heart of a shepherd, who has spiritual qualities, who is a leader, who sets the tone for the nation to follow, who's God's choice. And you know, a great prayer like that, because this is what Moses is doing when he's talking to God face to face, he's interceding. This is the heart of Moses. A great prayer like that will get a great answer to prayer. And God, of course, will provide a man just like Moses has prayed for. A man who is a leader, not a follower. A man who led his nation from the front, not from the back. A man who even said at the end of his life, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. He didn't need to ask his wife's opinion or his children's opinion when he made that statement. He says, no, I'm the leader of my home. And I lead my nation and I lead my family and we go the right way, no matter what the cost is. That was Joshua. A man who had a shepherd's heart. And you read the book of Joshua, you'll see the heart of him. You see the generosity of him. You see the selflessness of him. The servant heart of Joshua. And even when he received his inheritance, if you remember at the end of the book of Joshua, he was the last one to receive, not the first. And he took a very small inheritance for himself in the promised land. Joshua was God's man. And Moses was right to bring these qualifications to the Lord. And you know, we must learn the same lesson. We must learn the same lesson. We're living in a day where people are looking for leadership or leaders. And they often choose people who are very weak. People who follow the crowd. People who please the crowd. And they judge them by all kinds of external characteristics. How many qualifications he or she has. What school they went to. What university they went to. And they line up all the wrong qualifications. And if you do that, you get the wrong type of leader. And you end up with a mess. And you end up with confusion. And you'll discover that people will refuse to follow such people. And ultimately, any society, any nation, any church, any family that has the wrong leadership will end up going the wrong way. That's the reality of life. And God responds to Moses' request. And he lets Moses know, I have thought about this, Moses. Now, it would be very tempting, wouldn't it, for Moses to suggest someone's name here. But he resists the temptation. Because if Moses had said, I recommend person A or B or C, that person would always be beholden to Moses, wouldn't they? Moses chose me. I owe my position to Moses. And Moses very wisely doesn't get involved in naming names. He lets God name names. And now Joshua, when he takes over this nation, will know that he's not Moses' choice, primarily. He's God's choice. And God speaks in verse 18, and he lets Moses know, I'm not caught out by this, Moses. I have already planned this. I've already thought through this. I've already studied these individuals. And he says, take the Joshua. Now, let me just pause for a second and say this. Don't you see the connection for the umpteenth time in the Bible between a specific prayer and a specific answer to prayer? Oh, we see that all over the Bible. And it's there deliberately to tell us this is how God works. God calls us to the place of prayer. And we should pray and intercede for those in leadership and for future leaders. And God responds directly, and he says to Moses, I have a man and I have a plan. And here's the type of man he is. Take thee Joshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit. God says, here's the man that I've identified. And he's just like what you've asked for, Moses. He's a man that God is present in his life. The Spirit of God is upon him, in him. And he says, lay thine hand upon him and set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation and give him a charge in their sight. God says, listen, do this publicly, Moses. And you notice that he does this before Eleazar. Now, who was Eleazar? Eleazar was the third son of Aaron. If you remember, Aaron's first two sons were put to death, burned with the fire, Nadab and Abihu, for offering up strange fire at the altar. Possibly they were drunk as they were participating in the worship in the tabernacle. And the third son of Aaron was chosen by God to be his successor. Now, I'm sure Eleazar might have fancied himself as the next leader. I mean, Moses' sons doesn't appear to be in line here. Nadab and Abihu have been removed. Eleazar is the only blood relative of Moses that's holding a prominent position. He's the high priest. And maybe Eleazar would fancy a tilt at leadership, not just leading the worship, but leading the nation after Moses passes on. After all, he's related to Moses. After all, he has been serving with Moses and Aaron, his father, all these years. And God's very wise. He says, no, no, you bring Joshua out and you put him in charge before Eleazar and before the whole congregation. Let this be done publicly, no back doors. And lay your hands on him. Now, why is Moses to lay hands on him? As a sign that Moses agrees with God's choice. He's identifying with Joshua as a successor. He's passing on the baton in a very clear way with this object lesson of laying his hands on Joshua. And Eleazar is there representing the priesthood to show that he agrees with it. And the congregation agree with it. And of course, Moses, as God's representative, is representing God's will in the matter. God's choice. So God says, let this be done. And put thine honor on him, he says in verse 20, that all the congregation of the children of Israel may be obedient. Moses is to give a charge. He's to speak to the nation. He's to speak to Joshua. He's to remind them of their duties and responsibilities to each other. And he is to make sure that Joshua is honored. Now, this expression, put thine honor on him, can mean more than simply laying hands on him. It can mean Moses, start to transfer your power, your prestige. Let everybody look up to Joshua. He's no longer just Moses' assistant. He's God's man. He's God's leader. And Moses, you lift him up. You magnify him. You do what you can to give people trust and confidence in this man, Joshua. And God's saying to Moses, and he's saying to the nation of Israel, I know all about this man. He has the spiritual quality to succeed Moses. And what mattered most in the leader here was that he was not full of himself, but he was full of God. He had the Spirit of God. Now, verse 21 says this, and he shall stand, this is Joshua, before Eleazar the priest, who shall ask counsel for him after the judgment of before the Lord, at his word shall they go out, and at his word they shall come in, both he and all the children of Israel, with him even all the congregation. Now God says this, Joshua is going to have a similar role to Moses. He's going to lead this nation. But God also says something else, which is interesting. Joshua will have a slightly different role from Moses. They're going to be identical in certain ways, but they're going to be different in certain ways. Moses didn't go through the Urim and Thummim to find the will of God. God says he spoke to Moses face to face, if you remember. They had a special, intimate, and personal relationship that nobody else had before or after. And God says Moses is unique as a prophet, the way I deal with him. But Joshua is not going to be identical. There will be differences. There's going to be differences in temperament and abilities, and particularly in the role that I give him to do. He's not going to lead the nation the same way. Now, all of God's dealings with Israel were transacted through Moses, but not with Joshua. It's going to be more a different type of leadership, a more corporate leadership structure with Joshua. And I say this to you, don't try to create models of others. There's this awful tendency of people trying to imitate other people, trying to be mini so-and-so. They go to the workplace and they try to be an imitation of the founder or the CEO of that business. Or they go into the government and they try to imitate former political leaders and try to use mannerisms and vocabulary that they use and even outdated styles of leadership that they had before. And people do the same in the church. They do the same even in the homes. Certain sons take over their home, grow up, and they try to bring in everything from their past into their new home. It's not the way it's always meant to be. God has different styles of leadership for different styles or different times and different circumstances. And you and I are not to simply model other people. We're not to simply run a historical legacy society, a museum. I've been in churches, and all they talk about is what the founder said, who's already dead. And they produce his books, and they quote him, and it's like listening to a memorial service that just never ends. It's the same in businesses. I've been in countries, and they keep talking about this leader and that leader, and the person's been dead for years. Nobody has moved on. God makes it clear here to Moses, no, Joshua is going to be different from you. And Joshua, he's saying to Joshua as well, don't try to be a mini Moses. By all means, there's going to be some similarities in all types of leadership. There's going to be needed spiritual qualities. And there's things in Moses that you're going to have to draw from his example, Joshua, and learn from, and even imitate. But there's other things that you're going to have to leave behind. It's going to be different for you. Now, what does Moses do? Verse 22. And this is so typical of Moses. This is why he was such a great leader. Remember, up to this point, Moses may have suspected that Joshua would replace him. Moses may even have thought that Joshua would be a good person to replace him. But God hadn't given a confirmation yet. And God doesn't ask Moses' opinion. And Moses' pride could be hurt here, couldn't it? He said, let me just give you my opinion. And then you make the last decision, God. No. Nor does Moses say, Lord, can we just do a deal for my sons and my nephews when we're here? I mean, after all, I deserve something, don't I? And I've been here a long time. And Aaron got his son into the high priesthood. What about my son or my sons? Nor does he say to God, well, give me a moment to go around the nation and talk to the other leaders. Or have a poll to see is Joshua really popular enough. Sad to say, there are lots of leaders today, and that's how they behave. And they have their own little succession plans. And they particularly want to appoint their relatives and their friends and people who suck up to them and people who they think resemble them to be the next person to take over from them. And Moses here gives us a great example. He just waits for God to speak. And once God has spoken and made it so clear, Moses just obeys. It just says, and Moses did as the Lord commanded, without an argument, without any fluster, without any tears, throwing any tantrums. Moses just obeyed. And we're told he took Joshua, set him before Eleazar the priest, before all the congregation, and he laid his hands upon him and gave him a charge as the Lord commanded by the hand of Moses. Every single thing God told Moses to do, he did. Nothing added, nothing taken away. Obeyed it to the very last letter. And this is why Moses is so great. He leads Joshua by example. And he leads the nation from the front. Right to the very end. God says, bring Joshua. Moses just goes and does it. God says, lay your hands on Joshua. He just lays his hands on Joshua. God says, give him a charge to do the right thing. Moses does that. And he gives you and I such a wonderful picture of meekness, self-control, humility, and care for the needs of others. It's not about Moses. You see that in Moses' life? That's why the mistake he made in smiting the rock was so out of character. Because for Moses, all his life, he worked for others. He acted for the glory of God. And even in his successor, he does the same. He has the same attitude. He has the same actions. But what lessons should we learn from this chapter? And let me briefly run through them and you can write them down for yourself and note them. First lesson is this. All must retire at some point. All of us. None of us last forever. There's been some great leaders, hasn't there, in the scriptures, through the nation of Israel, through the New Testament church. But eventually there comes a moment when they pass on. They don't last forever. Moses was a tremendous leader, but his time was up in God's order, in God's kingdom. And nations, companies, churches, even families, eventually the leadership passes to another person. Parents have to learn to let go of their children when the time comes. Young men have to become leaders in their homes over their children and over their wives. The same in the church, the same in society, the same in the business world, the same in the management world. You have to learn to step aside. When God says your time is up, you have to walk away. And one of the tragedies is people trying to hang on further than what God wants them to hang on and doing great damage to the work of God. And when God removes, he replaces. God never runs out of workmen. Old John Wesley told the Methodist students that worked with him. He said this to them. He says, God buries the workmen, but never the work. He'll always have somebody to raise up. And don't pretend, and this is a great lie we tell ourselves, don't pretend and delude yourself that you are indispensable. Someone once said, the graveyard is full of indispensable people. Isn't that true? Your day will come. And be prepared that God will retire you and remove you from a particular position or place, and even from this earth eventually. But number two, learn this lesson from this story. God made the choice. Now, Moses is not a young man here. He's 120 years of age. Moses is the most educated, the most intelligent, the most spiritual of all the people in Israel. Remember, the whole generation of Jews, apart from Caleb and Joshua and Moses, died in the wilderness, who were above 20 years of age. So Moses is not just a little bit older than everybody. He's probably about 80, 90 years older than most people, maybe almost 100 years older. He is the wisest, most spiritual individual, and he has led this nation for 40 years, longer than anybody else has led them. And if anybody deserves, we would think, to have an opinion, if anybody has the right to get involved in this selection process, we would think Moses would have. But he doesn't. And Moses has learned, don't try to take God's place in this matter. Let God decide. Now, many others tried to replace Moses. Dathan and Abiram and Korah. Aaron and Miriam tried to replace him in rebellion. Many others tried to take his position. But Moses had learned in the 40 years in leading this nation, just let God choose. Just let God lead. Just let God be the great shepherd. You're the under-shepherd. You're not the chief shepherd. And now as he comes to this final handover, Moses is content to let God's will be done. Let God make the choice. But then notice something else about this story. God makes the choice in his time. I'm sure for Moses, he would have welcomed retirement. He might have welcomed spending some time with his grandchildren. As we would say in Singapore, getting his CPF and having a little time of relaxation before he dies. But that's not God's will. And let me say this to you, wherever you are. Don't set artificial deadlines. Don't say, well, God must do it this way in this time. No, he may not do it in this time. He doesn't work to your timetable. Let God make the choice. You know, often he doesn't make the choice for many, many years. He may not even make the choice in your lifetime. After Joshua, if you remember, there was a huge gap hundreds of years before Samuel came on the scene. And we had all these judges that God raised up who were very flawed individuals. But the next great leader after Joshua really was Samuel. You couldn't really say that Gideon or Samson and men like that were great leaders. They weren't. They were extremely flawed. And Joshua's life and heart and character was greatly influenced by Moses. And let me say this to you as well. It takes time to learn to be a great leader. Joshua took 40 years to learn the ropes, to learn the lessons from Moses' life. Very few nations, companies, churches, families last more than a few generations. Very, very few. Very few last. God isn't sentimental. We are, but God isn't. Old Hudson Taylor, when he was in charge of the China Inland Mission, used to tell people when they said to him, "What's going to happen after you die, Mr. Taylor? You're the man that holds the whole CIM together, and you're the one that people recognize all around the world. Your name is synonymous with the China Inland Mission. And if you're not there, what's going to happen?" Hudson Taylor used to say to people, "If God is through with it, I'm through with it. And if God's not through with it, I'm not through with it." That's the way I approach this. It's up to him. But then notice one other lesson. God made an unlikely choice in Joshua. Joshua was very different from Moses. He was from a different tribe. He was from Ephraim. Moses was a Levite, like Aaron and Eleazar. Joshua was not an educated man like Moses. Moses had been educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. Joshua was a slave boy, growing up in a slave home. Joshua was a soldier. He was a military man. He wasn't a writer. He wasn't a scholar like Moses. He didn't have this fierce temper that Moses had. He temperamentally was different. His talents were different. His upbringing was different. He was from a different tribe from Moses. And you know, sometimes we make the mistake of trying to choose people or look for people who are the same as somebody else. And it's a very unwise thing to do. Let God choose in His time, in His way. Don't try and second guess God. He often does the unexpected. In fact, we could say this, Moses himself was a very unlikely leader at 80 years of age to lead the nation for the next 40 years. In fact, Moses doubted whether it was even possible for him to lead the nation when he was at the burning bush. He said to the Lord, I think you've got the wrong person, got the wrong postcode here. I'm a shepherd now. I'm being this way for 40 years. I'm not strong enough. I'm not young enough. I'm not energetic enough. I'm not eloquent enough. I don't even know the language anymore. You've got the wrong guy. And God said to him, no, you're the right one. And it's the right time. You don't see what I can see. And God's way is often the unexpected way. He'll take the apostle who's the most educated, the most Jewish of all the apostles, called Paul or Saul of Tarsus, and he'll send him to be the apostle to the Gentiles. And he'll take the one who's rough and tough and uneducated, like Peter, the fisherman, the working class guy, and he'll send him to become the apostle to the Jews. God does things the opposite way that we think He has to do things. He makes unlikely choices. And God's choice is always for a man or a woman that has spiritual character, that has the right heart. And He chose Moses, He chose Joshua, He chose David because their heart was right. Not because of any talent or ethnic or racial background or any other external circumstance that we look for. No, God says, I'm choosing these individuals because they are the ones that impress me by their character. I see the potential in them. Let me finish by saying this. Is God's ability to choose leaders, God's ability to choose a leader of a home, a husband, or a wife, a parent, a Sunday school teacher, a church leader, a leader in the business world or the political, is God's ability limited to the days of Moses? No. Do you believe He can still answer prayer and lead you? And providence is not only believing that God is writing world history, but He's writing your history, your story as an individual. And such a wonderful story like this is a call to you and I. It's a reminder to you and I that God is saying, I still am in control. I still can be trusted to lead and guide. Leave the future to me. You just be faithful in the present and leave the future in my hands. We love to sing a little song in this church that Reverend William McCrae taught us a few years ago. And it says this, God's way is the best way. God's way is the right way. I trust in Him always. He knoweth the best. This hymn was written by a woman called Lida Leach. Lida Leach wanted to be a songwriter. And she had lots of artistic talents and gifts, and she believed that God had given her them to use for the glory of God. And she wrote many different hymns and poems, and she sent them off over and over and over again to different publishers. But nobody was interested in her hymns, in her poems. She was very discouraged. She went to talk to the pastor of her church, and she says, I'm going to give up. I'm not going to write a single poem or hymn ever again. And the pastor said to her, maybe you're just not ready to let God lead your life in this matter. And he said, just keep writing and just keep waiting for God to open the door. She went home and she wrote this hymn, God's Way is the Best Way. God's way is the right way. I trust in Him always. He knoweth the best. And of course, it's become a famous hymn now, all around the world for over 100 years. God's way is the best way. Joshua could say that. Moses could say that. And so can you, if you're willing to let God lead your life. Let's stand as we sing together this wonderful hymn, God's Way is the Best Way.